Life can be an extraordinary adventure. More than ordinary. In the gym. At home. At work. More than ordinary. Advice. Without the new agey bullshit.
Welcome to More Than Ordinary, brought to you by Seven Generation Games. I'm Anne Maria DeMars.
I'm Maria Burns Ortiz.
And because we had such an amazing response the last time, we had Jonathan Shaw in our studio, our author, tattoo artist extraordinaire, magazine editor, man of many talents, we have for you an encore.
I'm still Jonathan Shaw.
Last time, you know, we talked about your book, and I was reading your book, I was texting back and forth with her, and there was a part where I was saying, you know, especially in the beginning, I'm like, wow, you know, you guys kind of, she talks a lot about how she had a tough upbringing, her parents' situation very different, but there was a lot of similarities, and I was like, I think you guys have a lot in common, and then I go, well, and I just got to a part where he's hanging out with Charles Manson, but he wasn't Charles Manson yet, and then I go, oh, wait a minute. Now they just, somebody overdosed on drugs and I think they're dead and they rolled up in a rug. I think you guys aren't as quite as similar as I thought.
rolled them up like a jumbo burrito. You got to laugh to keep from crying sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, what's it like when you go back and you kind of pull those things out? Because they're probably not, you know, you don't sit around thinking of them every day, but you sit back and reflect and you're like, whoa, that was really surreal or crazy or, like you said, absurd kind of things.
Well, you kind of have to enter this zone, kind of like this neutrality sort of zone where it's like you're going into the past and it's like going into a dark neighborhood. You better have your guns and you better have your flashlight and you better have a couple guys watching your back. You're not just going to go traipsing around there unconsciously because there's dark elements. So I believe that some of the ammunition that I must take with me when I go into the past is I have to bring consciousness, I have to bring reverence, I have to bring gratitude, I have to bring a connection to the divine forces that inspire me, that guide me, that protect me, that teach me. I'm not going into a bad neighborhood unaccompanied. I'm not going there unarmed. I'm not going there naively because I get my ass whipped in a thousand different ways. For me, when I think about going into the past, I'm thinking about, oh shit, I'm going into a very dark place. Better be ready.
Well, let the record reflect that I never hung out with Charles Manson or buried any bodies. I think the closest probably is when I was in high school. I was at a party and everybody's doing LSD. And all of a sudden, this naked woman comes in, throws her hands up in the air, runs around in circles a few times and runs back out. And we're all kind of looking at each other. Did you see that too? Did that really happen?
I think I saw that.
You guys were at the same party. And one question I had, and this is, it ties into the book, but it was actually, I was reading your biography on your website too, and it says, and it kind of jumped out to me, because you talk a lot about your parents, and then it says there you have an adult son. I mean, this is probably something that could go on for hours and hours, but what's that like? I mean, what's your relationship like with your son, and how did that, was that shaped for you?
Well, my relationship with my son, thankfully, is a really nice, friendly, sort of respectful relationship. But I have to preface that by saying, you know, I was probably not the world's worst father, but thank God I was absent because I was not there. See, I was insane, drug addict, alcoholic for most of the years of my son's life. But see, I didn't know even I had a son until like some girl that I'd been involved with, it was a really toxic relationship, sort of confronted me one day as I was leaving a radio interview in Buenos Aires and came running up with this little kid and said, hey, this is your son. And I was just like, oh my God. So it was that kind of thing.
How old was he about?
At that time, he was probably about 7, 8, maybe 9. I don't even remember. I was still pretty stewed. I tried to have some sort of contact with him in those years, but I was still drinking it. I was not good father material, but we went out and we played pinball games and we hung out and we had a great time. And then I had to leave and I didn't really begin to have like a conscious relationship. And it was not a father-son kind of relationship because obviously it was too late for that. But I did begin a relationship with him when he was like 17. And that's around the time when I started really getting sober, like 17 years ago. So he's like 32 now or something. We've had a sort of a respectful, ongoing communication. And I even moved to Buenos Aires for a couple of years when he like turned 18, and I moved down there and spent 2 years there just for the purpose of hanging out with him and getting to build a relationship. But we had a good time, and I can't say I'm proud of him in the sense that I would take any credit for anything good that he is, but I'm proud of him just as a human being because he was raised pretty well by his mother. His mother was an insane person, and when she had this kid, she shaped up and she's dedicated her life to raising this kid, and she was an amazing mom and single mom, and she raised him as a stand-up guy. He's a good guy. He's like a martial artist. He's an amazing painter. He teaches classical painting. He's got a good life, and I can't take much credit for that.
Yeah, I've known people like that, that once they had a kid, they just totally turned around. It doesn't happen often, but yeah, you had a friend when I was in graduate school. It's just crazy, druggy, had worked at some minimum wage job, just enough money so he could come and smoke pot till he passed out. And his girlfriend got pregnant and he cut his hair, went out and bought khakis. And next thing you know, he's supervisor, manager. And they've got this kid in the house and, you know, the dog in the yard. But, you know, good for him.
Yeah, thank God. So, I mean, yeah, it does happen. I saw it happen and my hat's off to the mother of my son. She pulled herself out of like what looked like was going to be a downward spiral. And when she had this kid, she stood up and she took care of this kid because she knew I wasn't around. She knew I was a mess. But she always encouraged me to be there after I got myself sober. She was like, yeah, you should come and spend time with him. And we've had a good time. He's a good kid.
So I have a question I've been wanting to ask you. And I read a little bit of Carrie Fisher's book. Frankly, I did not find it as interesting as your book. But she said people used to always ask her, what was it like growing up with famous parents? Because Debbie Reynolds and Eddie Fisher were her dad. And she said, compared to what? Compared to on Thursdays when I lived in Phoenix, Arizona with Betty and Joe Ordinary. So you kind of grew up in that whole environment where you had a really famous father, you had a famous mother, you were around all these people, and then as a tattoo artist, and this is an interesting thing I noticed about you. You mentioned Johnny Depp's name once, but you have associated with so many super mega famous people, and you're really unusual in the, what I call them, Hollywood people I meet, that you don't do that. You don't say, oh, and Arnold Schwarzenegger is my really good friend, and Debbie Reynolds is my really good friend. And usually these Hollywood people, you meet them, and in the first 5 minutes, they have ran through the list of the name of everybody they know.
The best part is she doesn't know any of those people are, so they're trying to impress her, and right. She's like, huh?
It's true. Like, I could tell you, you know, who's the president of the American Statistical Association? I'm sitting next to someone, and they're on TV, and I have no clue. But you don't do that. And it also seems to me that people who are mega famous, that I hear younger kids, like teenagers, say, oh, you know, I really want to be famous and I want to be like this person, that person. And I think, you know, that sounds a lot like it sucks. And a lot of those people I wouldn't really want to hang out with. Like I mentioned our mutual friend Pete as being, I always tease him about the only honest guy in Hollywood because there used to be two and then the other guy moved away and now there's just Pete. So what's your take on the whole hanging out with the super mega famous people that everybody sees in the tabloids all the time?
It's interesting, maybe because I grew up around mega famous people who on the outside looked really good. But see, I grew up there and I could see that they weren't doing very good at all. It was like this beautiful mask. And then when the mask crumbles, you see this decrepit, rotting, soulless, just tortured world of just chaos and confusion and suffering. So famous people, not only are they not exempt from the trials and torments and the sufferings of everybody experiencing the human condition, not only are they not exempt from all of those torments and sufferings, they are also in many ways subject to another level of suffering that maybe Joe the mailman might not experience by virtue of their very fame itself. Because fame, it's a double-edged sword. I've seen it again and again and again from the time I could know myself as human. It's like money, man. It's just an energy form. Money can be put to great good. You can build schools and hospitals and shelters and help people and educate people and feed them and clothe them and really do so many uplifting things to support the edification of humanity with money. But think of all the horrible shit that gets done every day with money, with power. The money isn't evil. It's not evil. It's inert. It doesn't have a personality. Well, it's the same thing with fame. People with fame, if they're conscious, they can use that fame to tremendous good. But if they're unconscious, they can really fuck shit up in grand style. And we see this all the time.
Well, now you can tell me I'm full of bullshit because you have far, far more experience in this situation than I do. But from looking on the outside, what I see is it seems like being famous is a really toxic thing for a lot of people because everybody screws up. I was doing an interview with the BBC today and they asked me about this and everybody screws up. We all do. You do stupid things. You get drunk. You say something to someone that you wish you hadn't said. You make a mistake. You fail at something. But not all of us have to do that in front of 30 million people or see it in every newspaper tomorrow. So I think that is a bad side. And then there's also the side where everybody tells you everything you do is right.
That's the dangerous part. That's where it gets dangerous. Because like in olden times, I think it was it King James from the Bible? Is one of the kings from the Bible. He used to have a guy in his entourage. He was the king. He could do whatever the fuck he wanted. But he was a wise king. And he had a guy in his entourage whose sole purpose was to just cut him to ribbons all day long, to humiliate him. They called him the humiliator or something. It was kind of the principle of the court jester. These guys would come and they'd be like, fuck you, you know, make fun of the king. And there's a principle there. It's for ego reduction. Because if this guy's the king and he can take a shit on your head and everybody applauds, it's the emperor's new clothes, nobody's ever going to criticize the king because it's going to be off with their fucking head. So this wise king, he was wise enough to know that he needed somebody there constantly keeping him in check. And so he had this guy in his court, the humiliator, who'd just be following him around going, you ain't shit. You think you're being good, but you're just doing that because you want people to like you, you know, all this kind of thing.
I think that takes a great deal of wisdom to recognize that, though, because I think sometimes what happens is you have people that everyone around them is like, oh, you're so good, you're so great. And then if you do have somebody that says, probably shouldn't be doing so many drugs, if you're Michael Jackson, probably shouldn't be having 13-year-old boys sleep in your bed. Elvis Presley, wasn't there a single person around him that said, dude, you need to lose weight and quit the drugs? But no, because then you're the big mean person. Nobody else has a problem with it. And so people are afraid to do that. So I think this, I look at our family and I think we're talking about doing this reality show. We've been negotiating with production companies and working with Pete as a producer and all that. And everybody has cautioned me. This will be intrusive in your life. Keep Maria's kids out of the picture because they're small kids. Even Julia, who's 18. Think really, really hard about this. And one reason I think that we would survive that is we do have a pretty strong family. That, you know, like Rhonda, who's got a fair degree of fame, she comes home and Maria's kids jump on her in the living room and knock her down and climb on her because she's Aunt Rhonda. You know, they don't care. She came back from the Olympics the first time when she was 17 and both her and Jennifer had cats and Jen's a year older. And Jen's sitting on the couch when Rhonda walks in, coming back from Athens, and she looks up and she says, I don't care where you've been or what you won. It is so your turn to change the cat litter. I think
it's great.
It sounds like you did not have that. And what I see is a lot of athletes who come from tough bangs or a lot of people who come from those sort of Hollywood families, they don't have that. So you have the combination of that toxic fame environment and then no real
entitlement. It creates a feeling of entitlement. It's like, well, how dare you criticize me? That's so dangerous. That's the death. That's it. That's the death blow. As soon as you can do no wrong, you're fucked. It's like me and Pete, every weekend we go and we drink ayahuasca and get our asses kicked. We drink this foul-tasting plant medicine that makes us just tremble before the divine forces that allow us to even exist on this planet as these puny, destructive beings. And we are humbled. We are humbled, really, to our souls. And that's important. It's like you need to be, if you ain't got humility, man, I don't care. There's like a phrase that keeps coming to me, you know, what good is it to be great if you don't have nobility? And the nobility can only come through humility. And that usually comes at thorough humiliation for most of us. We need to get our asses kicked before we go like, okay, I'm sorry, I give.
You're far more spiritual than me. All I drank this weekend was NyQuil because I was sick, and it tasted disgusting.
We'll be right back.
Did you know that 92% of U.S. homes have a computer? Yes. Yes, they do. And 43% of homes have a child under 18. Why aren't more kids playing educational games on those computers? Because they suck. The educational games, not the kids. Until now, download Spirit Lake or Fish Lake. Check out Forgotten Trail or Making Camp with no download required. All of our games are under $10, teach math and social studies. Let your child play on a real computer and learn real-life math. If you're on Steam, be the coolest aunt, uncle, big brother, or sister on the block and download Fish Lake. The little rugrat can play on your computer, learn fractions, and you can get some peace while you talk on the phone to Vin.
Welcome back to More Than Ordinary, presented by Seven Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And I'm Anne-Marie Tamars.
And Jonathan Shaw is still with us. And this is the part of the podcast where we want to give people something they walk away from. So, you know, they hear stories, they think that's cool, I like that. But, you know, what lessons have you learned? And obviously your book is full of lots of them, but what's...
Re-tip.
Oh, sorry, actually, just kidding. I'm getting the hey signal over here from Anne-Maria. And she actually wants a tip specifically for her. Because... she lots of times have given lots of people tips and opinions and sometimes asked for, sometimes completely unsolicited tips onto how they should live their life better, what things they should do. But so I will let her ask her tip personally for herself from you.
Yes, usually I'm the one that gives the advice because, as Maria said, I am always brimming with advice, want it or not. But I have something I want advice on, and you are the perfect person to give me this advice. So our listeners and you and Maria will hear it off for the first time. I've been pondering going to Belize for a month and possibly staying somewhere in Belize for a month and writing my memoir. Everybody's always said you should write your autobiography. Well, and I always tell them I'm waiting for the statute of limitations to expire. And they think I'm joking, but I'm not. But there are a few reasons that I was thinking perhaps I would not do that. And listening to you, I'm still wondering about it. So the first is I don't think I could be as objective as you. One of the reasons I've never written an autobiography, even though I've had lots and lots of people suggest it, is I just think so many of those years sucked. And there were a lot of things that happened that were really bad, and being in juvenile hall and handcuffed to a bed. No, it was in a like Shades of Darkness or whatever the hell that book's named. But, you know, it was because I was in jail. And yeah, just a lot of bad stuff happened and being in foster homes. And I just think, why would you want to relive that? So I've thought about that and I thought, well, I also never been to therapy. I thought instead of, yeah, my defense mechanism would be totally repression. Like, okay, it's over. I'm going to go on and I'm going to get a PhD and win world championships and start some companies and do good. And all of the past is in the past. But now I'm debating if perhaps that would be a good thing.
Well, and yeah, I would say, you know, you have points where you can laugh and think she is the type where sometimes she'll be like, we'll bring up something. She just starts to get angry all over again. And you're like, wait, no. I meant that was like 20 years ago. We're good now.
So I thought maybe it would be cathartic. But then the other thing that I noticed listening to you is that you said things that probably were hurtful to some other people that you knew. And I know that some of the stuff would be hurtful to people that I care about. Like, for example, maybe somebody did something really awful, and I don't care about that person, but maybe their son or their, you know, brother is somebody I really care about and it would bother them. So, you know, that degree of honesty. And then the other thing is, if I took away off for a month, and Maria can vouch for this, I have never taken a month off in my entire life. I've worked since I was 15 years old, and I am not sure I've ever taken a full week off. I usually work 7 days a week. And so listening to you and reading the beginning of your book, it's kind of like thinking you don't owe your life to anybody. And so if you want to take a few weeks off and do something different, so should I go to Belize and write my memoir or not?
Well, after that lead up, first of all, you've got a word printed right over your heart. And that word, sabio, you know what that means, right?
Claro que sí.
So... you already know, you already have the wisdom etched right over your heart and no doubt in your heart. So you already have all the answers to all of your questions. So it's just my job to maybe remind you of some stuff that you already know and help you to maybe bring that stuff to the surface for further consideration and study in your own process of answering your own question, because you got the answer. It's right there on your heart. You were sort of going through some pros and cons about this thing. And one of the cons that you mentioned was you don't want the truth to be hurtful or painful to anybody. And this is a motto of mine, and I've said it a million times to the point where it sounds corny, but I mean, this was given to me through experience and through teachings that I had to sign up for. And the point is, the truth will set you free, but it's probably going to hurt. And that probably is only in there to be polite. It's going to hurt. And you know the principle as an athlete, as somebody that worked all your life in athletic circumstances, the old saying, no pain, no gain. So, I mean, these are all principles that apply to this brutally honest approach to putting one's own story into context for the purpose of cathartic experience and, you know, also to tell a story that might just maybe be of great benefit to your fellow human beings. At that point, you're putting yourself to the side and saying, how can I be of service to others? Maybe there's enough wisdom and experience and pain and cathartic growth to my story that I can share that experience with other people and actually put myself in a selfless position of maybe contributing something good to that kid who's sitting there scratching his head going, what the fuck does it all mean? How do I make some sense out of this horrible life I've been handed? And to hear your story might just be that catalyst that makes that kid go like, well, shit, she could go through all this and come out and now do this and that and the other thing. Who am I to sit here feeling sorry for myself? It could just be that seed that you planted somewhere that could sprout into like this magnificent plant that could grow up and become this magnificent tree full of fruits to nourish a multitude of human beings. So that's my pitch for you to say yes to that inner calling and all that other shit. It's like irrelevant, man. So what if somebody gets hurt? You cannot make an omelet without breaking a few eggs. The omelet's going to feed the souls of many people. Somebody's ego has to get shattered. They have to wake up and go, yeah, man, Jesus, I really was an asshole. Fuck, why did she have to talk about that? But at the end of the day, you're doing them a great service. You're doing a great service to their soul. Their ego's not going to like it. But, you know, the truth will set you free. Yes, it's going to hurt. So, you know, as far as Belize, I opened a tattoo shop in fucking Belize City in 19...
We were just there.
In 1976, when I can't even imagine what it's like today, but in 1976, it was a fucking pit. I mean, a pit. The whole place smelled like everybody in the whole country just shit their pants at once. I mean, there was open sewers, these canals running through the shanty towns. And just there was tin cans coming out of people's pipes, shacks made out of tin cans, and you would just literally see the turds just dropping into the canals, and then these hungry, gnarly, shit-fed catfish would run up and fight over these things. I mean, it was it was a pirate town. It was an insane place. Well, I'm talking 1976.
I was thinking more Belmopan or San Ignacio, and we were there, and there was no shit-fed cactuses.
No, this is catfish. Catfish.
There are not catfish, shit-fed catfishes either.
Well, this was 1976. That's a world ago. I mean, we were kids then. And this was 1976. That was a rough fucking place, man. I mean, it was gnarly. There wasn't a paved road in that place. And I sat there tattooing sailors and British troops because they had a big... It was British Honduras still. And I was living in this insane... I got a whole chapters of my book, the next couple books about my years in Belize before Belize became a popular tourist destination. It must be wonderful now. And then they got those islands and everything out there, which I used to go to recover from hangovers by drinking opium cough syrup codeine cough syrup that you could buy over the counter at the main drugstore in Belize City. Anyway, Belize is a lovely place. What a better place to go and never mind the shit-fed catfish. You just go out to that island out there and sit there under a fucking coconut palm and write your story, girl, because you can help people in so many ways, and you're going to help yourself. You're going to be a happier, more complete, more well-adjusted human being. Not to imply that you aren't already, but you can always do better. And, I mean, it's been nothing but a blessing for me doing this stuff. And it's hard work, and it's painful, and it sucks, but the alternative sucks worse.
I would just like you to remember to paint me as the angelic, supporting heroine with no flaws that I am.
Yeah.
I could just see Maria sitting here, though, because she's CEO of Seven Generation Games, thinking, okay, where are we going to get a software developer statistician for that month while you're gone? So maybe we'll have to do a Kickstarter campaign or something to bring in money to put in a one-month replacement for me.
Send my mom to Belize.
I'm more thinking of all the angry phone calls that will follow when the publication comes out, or even in advance, panicked calls. I'll be getting like, what does it say about me? What's it say? What's it?
Spend $20 and read the book. That's the only way you're going to know.
Thanks for listening to the More Than Ordinary podcast.
For more information, please go to our website, 7GenerationGames.com. And that's 7 as in the number 7, GenerationGames.com.
If you'd like to learn more about math and history, or increase your vocabulary while at the same time having fun, you can purchase our games at 7GenerationGames.com/buy.
You can also donate and help a much-deserving student.
And as always, please tell a friend and don't forget to rate us on iTunes.
It's never too late to be more than ordinary.